When I was teaching, I always used to dread having to teach students at this hour because their stomachs were full and they were slowly about to drift off. So it's a rather substantial challenge. It's interesting to me that these wonderful talks that we've heard so far have, in at least two cases, covered the same topic. And I'm the third to address this same topic. War and Peace in Thomas Merton is my topic. And my predecessors have not overlapped all that much, and I think I will not either. It's interesting. The richness of Merton is such that this can happen. One doesn't worry in advance about this sort of thing with Merton because there's so many aspects to his work. The particular interest that I have in Merton in regard to this topic is in the structure of his thinking about war and peace. So I'm interested in how these balance out, and I think the word balance is well chosen here. Merton had a very balanced view of things with respect to war and peace. He is also, and this is a kind of contextualization, I suppose, of his thinking about war and peace. He is what he called a Christian humanist. And that is how I see him. And that is how I see the rootedness of these matters of war and peace in Merton. And by Christian humanism, I understand, and I think he understood, a tradition that led both from the Judeo-Christian tradition and also from the classics of philosophy, the Greek philosophers. And so I see these two streams coming together in Merton. And one of the things that I'll talk about is Merton's interest in an affirmation of rationality. This is something I haven't done much of in my own thinking about Merton because I've tended to talk a lot about him as an intuitive person, which he is. But I've argued, too, that the distance between intuition and rationality is not great. It's not as great as it's thought to be. But anyway, today I'm more interested in reasoning in Merton. And so if I were to anticipate the ending of this little talk, I would say probably something like this, that from Merton's point of view, nonviolence is rational. Is rational. So that's where we're headed. I hope you want to come on this kind of trip. And so I might just begin by talking about Merton's relationship to that Greek philosophy that I talked about. In The Seven-Story Mountain, if you've read the book, you'll recall that he shrugs off Plato because he finds Plato too abstract. But later on in the late 50s, he said in his journal, talking to himself, he said he had always been a Platonist, always been a Platonist. So, and what I think he had in mind here was what he recognized in Plato was the pursuit of ultimate truth. And so in Plato, when you pursue ultimate truth, then you can rank the other goods or truths in your life because you know the ultimate one, so to speak. And Merton identified with that throughout his life. And you want to think, I think, of Plato as somebody who was struggling with the very things we were talking about in, for example, in Hannah's meeting this morning, that is the reconciling of the good and, say, politics. Plato was concerned with those issues and, in fact, as you probably know, tried rather unsuccessfully to implement a political system in Syracuse. It was a total disaster, but his thinking about it was one of total commitment to the good and politics intermingling, so to speak. And I think this is true of Merton's thinking about war and peace as well. So we have this valuing of reason in the Greeks, and they, in effect, teach us that. They teach us the value of reason. And I think throughout Merton, we find this being reaffirmed. For example, he said in relationship to the evil in the world, he said, the man who is outside the orbit of God's grace is not normally governed by reason, but by passion. And that's language that Plato would understand. He would have called it the rule of appetite. But it's present in Merton, as is Merton's use of reason as a kind of search engine for ultimate truth, or what he would call wisdom. And this focus on ultimate truth in Merton, he felt, would help to forestall the spurious use of reason. That is, the such as, for example, the advocating of means that are justified by their ends. And you've already been introduced to the essay about Adolf Eichmann, the very famous essay which Merton wrote about Eichmann. And there Merton really talks about what we could call the instrumental use of reason. That is, the use of reason for causes that lie beneath that use of reason that are themselves far from reasonable. And, of course, for Merton, Nazi Germany was a perfect example of that sort of thing, of the instrumental use of reason. So as long as Eichmann was in his position where he could order things, and Albert Speer and so on, these people were in positions where they could live in an orderly environment, it seemed reasonable to live in that kind of environment. But then when you look at the underlying causes or movements towards that society, so to speak, you find the unreasonable. The other thing that Merton was interested in and played off against his interest in the Greek philosophers was the philosophy of utilitarianism, which is our philosophy. This is the philosophy that governs our lives now, the philosophy of Bentham and Mill. And we are so close to this philosophy, we probably don't recognize it. The greatest good for the greatest number. And Merton said, the problem with that system is that it's a system based on personal preferences. And so, not a system based on the search for the good or the search for the true, but on personal preferences. And for Merton, in that sense, the order of the world reflected the order of the mind of human beings and of God as well. And this order would be disturbed by fractures in reasonable thinking. Merton really liked someone like Aquinas, who was able to combine Christian mysticism with an Aristotelian and rational metaphysics, so that Aquinas's writing seemed to Merton to generate a sudden kind of brilliant intuitive insight, that's the mystical part of him, but also to generate a reasoning that appealed to the intellect and to experience, to the actual world in which we make decisions. In the introduction to a book called Breakthrough to Peace in 62, Merton said that the book was humanistic in the deepest and most spiritual sense of the word. And the purpose of Christian humanism, he felt, was the liberation of human beings from the level of animals to rational thinkers and then to spiritual beings. That was the evolution. Merton was sensitive to the emergence of the spiritual from the physical context of human life, even in the case of an apparent materialist like Marx, whom he described as a genuine humanist in some respects. Moreover, in Merton's view, Christian humanism involved its proponents in the shaping of history, a natural concept for someone like himself who had been immersed in incarnational Christian theology. In spite of Merton's balancing of classicism and Christianity, he certainly revealed the fissures that existed between the two. In the Republic, for example, which Merton had studied in the original Greek in his school days in England, Plato takes the view there that if one can produce a rational and therefore just social order, then the usual kinds of conflict-producing friction would fall into abeyance. Less sanguine about the power of reason to go it alone, Merton, as a Christian, believed that such a sought-for social order would inevitably be subverted by the human tendency to give rein to individualistic desires and passions. And here he quotes, though, another Greek, Thucydides, in connection with the Peloponnesian War, where Merton argues that the distraction caused by such emotional behavior would cause the most thoughtful citizens to withdraw from public debate in despair. which is a very real problem in this kind of society in which we live, that thoughtful people withdraw from the debate. They see madness when they look around them. And so, as Ron Dart was saying in the session earlier this morning, to motivate them to move into politics is becoming more and more difficult. War, in Merton's view, was a fracturing of a primordial and still longed-for unity that had originally characterized human life. If the Greek philosophers and Aquinas had expressed the rational side of humanism, compassion, as one might find it expressed in the Gospels, represented the intuitive and loving aspects of human nature. As in Rousseau and Blake, for Merton, compassion could be undermined by the hierarchical aspects of socialized living, through which some members of society divided themselves from others. For Merton, this was the expression of a perverse centrifugal scattering of individuals into their own personal, ethnic, or nationalistic egos. A return to human unity required a recognition of the superior truthfulness of the paradigm of unity and of the innate compassion that would, if permitted to do so, cause us to desire that unity. Like Rousseau, whose confessions Merton mentions in his early journal, Merton believed that the innateness of the survival instinct was paralleled by a powerful compassion that united beings with one another. So this is all what we've been talking about, this business of survival, that's the fear. The fear we're not going to survive. And so Merton is saying, well, there is that, we are like that, but we are also compassionate, and we have to hear that voice, so to speak, within us. It is this innate compassion that Merton felt made following the Christian commandment to love possible, and thereby made possible the reduction of aggression among individuals and political states. At the same time, the chill of the Cold War mentality, which he observed in the 50s and 60s, would inevitably, he believed, sterilize the innate human capacity for compassion and love. If for philosophers like Plato, Descartes, and Rousseau, reason was a central aspect of the divine, for Merton, the divine was even more completely and sharply manifested in the person of Christ. In Christ, one found a paradigm of the divine uniquely displayed in the human. In particular, Christ was a perfect configuration of the wisdom and compassion that both symbolized and embodied the restored unity of the human condition. If the Christian ethos emphasized the latent unity of human beings, war, Merton suggested, rested on the assumption that the enemy was different from and therefore separate from ourselves. Since Merton rejected force as the basis of political authority, and here he's rejecting people like Hobbes and Nietzsche, Hobbes, who had said, do you remember, that life was short, mean, and brutish. That is, that life is a jungle, in effect. So Merton rejects that. And Nietzsche, of course, is the will, the philosopher of the will, the power that will conveys. So Merton is doubtful, though, about the ability of reason alone to prevail. And then, so the question arises, what, in his view, was the source of political authority? And he answers this question. Reason and conscience, he concluded, the two in apparent and profound harmony. The mention of conscience gave an ethical and hence rational connotation to the innate compassion that Merton insisted, if encouraged, would help to restore human unity. For Merton, freedom did not operate in a void, but needed to be guided by a rational estimate of reality. In this way, justice, moved by an innate human compassion that was flanked by reason, would become embodied in human experience and history. In terms of Christian humanism, Merton felt that the human mind in its deep, primordial, and unperverted state not only mirrored in miniature the order of the divine mind, but reflected as well the love of the Creator for the created universe. For this reason, Merton concluded that if the roots of peace had not been implanted in our being, the condemning of war would be futile and meaningless. He noted that the salient difference in the attitude toward peace between Pope John XXIII and Machiavelli was not that John XXIII believed in God and Machiavelli did not, but rather that John XXIII believed in man and Machiavelli did not. If human nature were fundamentally evil, Merton observed, then the authorities of the world would have no other choice but to take up arms against it and keep it in a blind and disciplined servitude. Merton read a book in the 60s called On Aggression. I don't know if you're familiar with it, by a man named Conrad Lorenz. And he responded to Lorenz's claims and depiction of human beings in that book. In an essay on religious faith and violence published in 68, Merton argued that aggressiveness toward their own kind was atypical of animals, that humans were all but unique in wantonly and cruelly attacking their own kind in what he termed a provoked and murderous hostility. Merton pointed out the irony of Christians throughout history murdering each other in the name of the God of peace. In Merton's view, citizens in the West, driven both by fear and a misplaced deference to secular authority, had frequently neglected to form and to consult their own consciences. And he saw this, of course, in the Nazi regime in Germany. And he describes what happened at Auschwitz as a successful administrative enterprise, which was made possible by the willingness of people to take orders, to follow what appears to be the recognized, constituted authority. And Merton called this a lamentable moral passivity. And he gives the example, in contrast, of Franz Jagerstatter. Have you heard of him at all? He's the man who stood up, the Austrian farmer who stood up, the only man in his village to stand up and say he would not fight for Germany under the Nazis because he believed the war to be contrary to his Christian principles. And he was urged to join the military by his priest, by his bishop, and both accused him of a kind of vanity in going his own way, in refusing to comply, and said to him, if the bishops of Germany have not objected to this war, who are you to object to it? That's pressure. And yet he went his own way. And he's the subject, incidentally, of a very fine book by Gordon Zahn it's called In Solitary Witness. The dilemma of the Christian who is drawn into participation in a war whose morality he is considered incompetent to judge was compounded in Merton's estimation by the bureaucratic nature of modern war. War in which the senior bureaucrats tended to be sheltered from the sight of blood unless, as Merton put it wryly, a secretary gets a nosebleed. It seemed to Merton that church officialdom in the West had tacitly accepted the policies of their governments in much the same way as had non-believers. The reason was that many Christians in the West identified European-American civilization with Christianity, a cardinal error in a period that Merton emphatically referred to as post-Christian. In asserting the need for an active, personal conscience, Merton observed that when a war was evidently unjust, one may not only refuse to serve in the military, one was obliged not to serve in the military. Putting the matter succinctly, he maintained that the noble concept of duty and civic sacrifice should never be debased to the point where the citizen, especially the Christian citizen, became the passive instrument of inhuman governments. Merton saw the rise of nationalism historically as a morally dubious ingredient in the history of war and peace. What began the Second World War, he asked rhetorically, but the rabid, short-sighted, irrational, and stubborn forces that tend to come to a head in nationalism. Due to nationalist ideologies, he maintained, there had been a breaking up of the order of civilized society. Among these disruptive forces, he included communism, which, interestingly enough, he called an intense nationalism that had overtaken some of those peoples who had lagged behind in the 19th and 20th centuries. For Merton, the most grotesque triumph of nationalism was in Nazi Germany, where German Christians docilely served a leader who was anti-Christian. Merton questioned the willingness of human beings to kill each other in the name of inflated nationalistic myths, and he contrasted the nationalistic myths that proclaimed cultural superiority with the kind of communal attachment expressed by people who happily and gratefully share a common history and geography. There's a famous contrast made by G.K. Chesterton in an essay called The Flag of the World. I don't know if you're familiar with it. Chesterton was when Merton was an adolescent, he had Chesterton on his list of people to admire and wanted his autograph and so on. Chesterton makes that distinction between nationalism and the inflated myths that surround it and communal pleasure, communal relaxed communal state where people simply enjoy their common knowledge and their life together, so to speak. These are very different things, Merton is saying, as had Chesterton. One is very dangerous, the other one's very healthy. Shaped by his nomadic upbringing in Europe and America, Merton was an internationalist who urged the creation of an international authority to settle conflicts between nation states. One would say Canada is such a nation that has seemingly lost its way in this respect. He tended to depart from both the secular and religious outlook of his fellow Americans. In the case of fellow Catholics, there was strong support in the early 60s for American nationalism, especially under President Kennedy. Furthermore, with its emphasis on rugged individualism, American nationalism seemed to Merton a sinister reminder of Hobbes rather than of the Christian ethos. Moreover, he thought of himself not simply as a citizen of the United States, but of all of the Americas, and developed a strong interest in and attachment to Latin American culture and to a number of Latin Americans. Merton made it clear that he was not a pacifist in that he did not take an a priori view that all war was morally wrong. Furthermore, he argued that a display of weakness in the face of an obviously ruthless aggressor could be interpreted as an invitation to be conquered, a moral wrong in itself, since it would be, from Merton's point of view, an encouragement to evil. By the same token, the mounting of a military defense against an unjust aggressor, Merton noted, was not only morally right, but morally obligatory. As a Christian, Merton found himself, in thinking about these issues, having to come to terms with the Augustinian theory of the just war, a theory that had influenced Western thought in both the religious and secular spheres for centuries. Spurred in part by the collapse of the Roman Empire under the onslaught of the barbarian armies from the north, Augustine concluded that it was impossible for human beings to live near each other without conflict erupting at some point. At the same time, conscious that a Christian must act out of love, Augustine formulated a scenario in which human beings are morally empowered to defend themselves in a measured response to unwarranted aggression. This response included the proviso that no greater violence could be used than that needed to stop an unjust aggressor, and that this restraint should manifest to the aggressor an overriding desire for peace on the part of the Christian defender. While Merton could accept the terms of Augustine's thinking in theory, he argued that the good intentions of the just war practitioner would almost invariably give way in practice to a behavior that, born in violence, could never hope to follow the Christian law of love. By way of example, Merton believed that in the case of the Spanish Inquisition, there was an enormous gap between the moral objectives of the Inquisition in theory and the horrors of the Inquisition in practice. Furthermore, even when a war was determined to be a just war, such as the resistance to Hitler, let us say, such a war could and often did become unjust. So a just war might be just at the beginning, but then devolve to something unjust. Merton would argue that it would likely do so, especially when the nation or people waging the war resorted to unjust means. And here he talks about the Second World War and the behavior of the Allied forces over Dresden, over Hanover, and in Japan, and so on, as morally problematic. And he talks about the role of British Air Marshal Harris, or people might know him by the name of Bomber Harris. And so he uses this as an example of a war, the Second World War, which began apparently with ground rules that recalled Augustine's just war, but then devolved morally as the war went on, as people resorted to more extreme measures and measures which involved the destruction of large populations of civilians. The argument put forward by what Merton called the nuclear realists in the 60s, that there was now no clear way of distinguishing between the role of civilians and of the military in a war in which all of a nation's resources and people are marshaled, seemed to Merton a specious argument. This was because it could be applied too loosely to those who contributed in any way, no matter how trivially or indirectly, to the war effort, and because it overlooked the possibility and indeed the likelihood that the ordinary citizens of a nation might be ideologically detached from their governments. I might just take a moment to tell you of an experience I had in 1967 when I was in East Berlin for a short time and got into conversation with my brother-in-law, who speaks fluent German, with some ordinary people in East Berlin. It was quite clear to me that these people had no love for their government, and they seemed to be no one spoke against what they were saying in this group in which we were involved. So Merton makes a very valid point here, because the point he's making is that the missiles in the West were trained on these very people, the people who were detached from their governments. We had trained the missiles. We had lined them up, so to speak. So I think it's a good point. And anyway, in any case, with its vision of massive human and ecological annihilation, the political and military climate of nuclear deterrence of the 50s and 60s was a major departure from the sort of scenario that Augustine had in mind in formulating his the just war theory. Nuclear war, in Merton's view, constituted a moral evil so immense that it could not be justified even to defend the highest and most sacrosanct of values, including the survival of Western civilization and of Christianity itself. In one sense, Merton felt that the isolation of nuclear weaponry was the monster of modern warfare. But he thought that this overlooked the fact that biological and chemical weapons could have effects that were equally devastating. The use of such doomsday weapons, he noted, would mean that the weapons with which Christians try to destroy their enemies would, quote, pass through their own hearts. In other words, the Christian warrior, even in defending and using this kind of weapon, would destroy the very Christianity within himself or herself that he or she was trying to assert in that defense. In this case, because the weapon was way out of proportion to the offense, so to speak, or the cause of the war. These are strong words, I realize, and they're words to think about as you read and think about Merton's writings. Nuclear deterrence for Merton involved the reckless attempt of one nuclear power to restrain another by convincing the other that in order to protect its people and culture, it would not hesitate to unleash a nuclear barrage of cataclysmic proportions. Merton regarded the passive acceptance of nuclear deterrence as a sort of moral sleepwalking. And again, this is language which comes home to us. Both our earlier speakers have said how Merton's language seems so contemporary, so au courant, so part of our present situation. And he says, pure madness. Along with the specious rationality of nuclear deterrence, Merton found himself at odds with those who espoused the waging of a limited nuclear war. He saw this as an example of a war deemed to be just at the outset, but then likely to sink into injustice as it wore on. The reason why a limited nuclear war would likely devolve into an unlimited nuclear war came from the likelihood that the loser in a limited war would resort to massive retaliation in order not to lose. Does that sound likely? Such a turn of events would ensue, Merton calculated, as the military forces on the losing side, stung by defeat, co-opted the civilian government into adopting a more radical policy of engagement. Does that sound like anything going on now? Furthermore, reflecting on the writings of the Prussian military strategist von Clausewitz, Merton came to understand that the idea of a limited or moderate war flew in the face of the nature of war, whose violence was ineluctably oriented to winning at all costs. Furthermore, although the weaponry of war was in a sense morally neutral, the development of a massively powerful weapons with their economies of scale meant that inevitably the weapons themselves would, by their very massiveness, blur the distinctions between combatants and non-combatants. And thus the technology of war would control the technologists of war. So that those bombs are so economically produced in this massive effect that they have, that they're irresistible. The economies of scale work in favor of them. And then once that is the weapon within the arsenal, that's what calls the shots over the technologists. Merton's analysis of why governments and their citizens had allowed themselves to drift into such a moral quagmire was because they lacked an ethical philosophy that could withstand the arguments of the pragmatists. In such a state of drift, he believed, nations might be expected to place the lives of thousands of people at risk over provocations that were not dire. In Merton's view, the consciences of American citizens had been anesthetized by the fearful belief that only war or the threat of war was an effective means of defense, and that peacemaking was unlikely to cause opposing nations to settle their differences. This view Merton regarded as a collective illusion and insisted that peacemaking, the ostensible goal of the Christian, and the one that Merton described as more arduous by far than war, was nevertheless the only alternative to war. Nevertheless, he conceded in his essay, Peace and Revolution, that mere words about peace, love, and civilization were unlikely to resolve serious conflicts. Having been strongly influenced by Gandhi, Merton believed in the power of nonviolent resistance and negotiation to achieve peace. This could be accomplished in part by the clearing away of the obfuscation produced by ambiguous and euphemistic political discourse. a theme that Orwell had explored in a very famous essay in which Merton had read. And Merton himself produced a very interesting essay, I haven't time for this, but an essay called War and the Crisis of Language, which you might like to look at sometime. He thought that this kind of nonviolence was a kind of language, that the nonviolent person spoke to the community, and that this became a way of purifying language, cutting the junk out of it, so to speak, so that communication then became possible between adversaries and others involved in an adversarial situation. Calling for nonviolent resistance directed against the hawks of war, Merton focused on the potency of spiritual weapons. He distinguished nonviolent resistance from what he called a passive acquiescence in evil, which in turn, he said, amounted to a travesty of Christian meekness. Blessed are the meek, but not these meek, not these meek people. Against the contemporary context in the West, which he believed had shed any pretense of representing Christian ethics, Merton maintained that nonviolent protest would be most effectively carried out by creative people whose spirituality would produce fresh and radical forms of social and political engagement, forms that lay beyond the conventional responses of either state or church. In thinking about examples of nonviolent resistance in the 20th century, he was impressed by the Danish people during the occupation by the Nazis. Do you all know that story of, you know, the Nazis wanted the Danish government to cooperate in isolating and then leading to the execution of the Jewish peoples, and the response from the government of Denmark to this suggestion that the Jews wear a badge to identify themselves, their response was that the king of Denmark would be the first to wear that badge. And from Merton's point of view, this was effective nonviolent resistance, especially since it didn't really involve direct confrontation or that sort of in-their-face kind of action, but quite a lot of subtle wearing down of the system in order to thwart attempts of the Nazis to execute the Jews. Merton thought this was wonderful, but he did say that with regard to the West in the 1960s, bereft of a coherent moral philosophy, he doubted that Western nations would be capable of such grace under pressure. That's my phrase from, of course, Hemingway. But it's what he thought. I think it's how he thought about the way the Danes handled this situation. Although Merton's nonviolence can be seen in his early novel, My Argument with the Gestapo, a coherent moral philosophy in relation to war and peace had grown out of his experience with the contemplative traditions of both East and West. The effective peacemaker would be one who had a deep, quote, intuition of being, end quote, as Gandhi had shown, in which political action flowed from a prior fidelity to wholeness and being. In Merton's view, the contemplative was more sensitive than many people to the richness and unity of being, and thus would be readier than most to work towards the unity of all human beings. One is not completely human, Merton declared, until one has experienced one's humanity, not only in terms of Western culture, but in terms of one's African and Asian, and I'm quoting here, and Indonesian brother. Such a consciousness of human inclusiveness, a corollary of what I was calling compassion before, of Christian compassion, would be a salutary prerequisite for the role of peacemaking, a role that for Merton meant far more than the avoidance of war. A search for the content and value of one's humanity within the cultural experience of others predisposed one, he maintained, to an openness to truth, including the truth in one's adversary. Having discovered the truth in one's adversary or enemy, the peacemaker would then be in a position to understand his or her own truth realistically. In turn, Merton declared that following the example of the Christian God, who was able to love sinful human beings, the Christian peacemaker needed to make every effort to love an enemy who nevertheless might not inspire trust. This can be done, he suggested, because in a sense, and I think this is a very fine insight, in a sense, this is how we often behave with regard to ourselves. I don't know what, should I go over that? That was just a wonderful insight, that the Christian peacemaker needed to make every effort to love an enemy who nevertheless might not inspire trust. This can be done, he suggested, because in a sense, this is how we behave often with regard to ourselves. We love ourselves, we don't trust ourselves. That we have a basis in experience to begin this further application, so to speak, of that paradox in our relationship with others, especially adversarial others. With his eye ever on inclusiveness, Merton argued that the obtaining of the most precious and elusive truths would lead to the perception that truth, political or otherwise, as in a Platonic dialogue, was the result of collaboration. When applied to the problems of war and peace, Merton's philosophy of inclusiveness with its ethos of collaboration means that instead of taking the side of one or another nation, the peacemaker joins collaboratively with the combatants to fight against war itself. Considering peacemaking within a specifically Christian context, Merton recalled that early Christians had visualized themselves as living in two worlds simultaneously, the city of God and the city of man, as Augustine put it. War was relegated to the city of man, a city whose lifespan the early Christians regarded as temporary and in a state of imminent collapse. For this reason, early Christians, in Merton's judgment, were not preoccupied with specific solutions to conflict and war, but were rather interested in an overall spiritual view of human nature as the hub of all such questions. In some ways, he noted, this was the view taken by John the 23rd in the encyclical Pacem in Terris, Peace in the World. Instead of plunging into the technicalities involved in various global conflicts, John the 23rd called attention to the fundamental ideas on which peace among nations must always depend. Without this sort of context, Merton believed the stupefying myriad of strategic discussions that were a part of political negotiations took place in a moral vacuum in which the only guideposts were the drives and wants of the warring parties. At the same time, he dissociated himself from the merely abstract condemnation of war. Rather like his thinking about war and peace in general, Merton's views about nonviolence were related to his Christian humanism, even if this included the central role played by Gandhi. Merton thought of Gandhi as in part embracing Christian values. And as I was chatting about this morning with someone, and we recalled Gandhi's love of the Sermon on the Mount in particular. It doesn't mean that this replaces Gandhi's Eastern religious views and knowledge and commitment and so on, but Gandhi seems to have had a kind of inclusive mind in this respect in the way in which Merton did. And Gandhi, according to Merton, in his nonviolent approach to things, was trying to assert the values and structures of civilization. More than these values were fostered by the secular and religious establishment. That establishment, Merton argued, while ostensibly the custodian of civilization, often subverted important civilized values. And these values that were subverted were the values that were needed for peace. Nonviolence of the sort practiced by Gandhi, Merton called a religious humanism, and they defended all that was best and highest, he said, in civilization. With its incarnational theology, Christian humanism focused, Merton stated, not on the separation of matter and spirit, as the early Christians had done, but on the importance of the spiritualizing of matter. Unlike the Platonic project, with its emphasis on enlightened consciousness, Christian humanism pointed to an innate inclination toward compassion and unity that recalled Francis of Assisi more than it did Plato. Merton's first choice in connection with the religious life was, you recall, to join the Franciscans, something that never came to pass. Francis had affirmed the underlying compassion present in human nature, a compassion that, as Merton phrased it, taught him that when, quote, my brother dies, I too die. Compassion teaches me that my brother and I are one. For Merton, as Christian, the tearing of the fabric of human unity through war was an unspeakable evil and an affront to the compassionate God who had in love created those who would in betrayal become the war makers. For Merton, as humanist, drawing on the richness of classicism and Christianity, the war makers of history, in destroying the precious creations of human civilization, had thereby desecrated being itself. The most effective response to such desecration, Merton believed, would come not from religious institutions as such, but as in the case of Gandhi, from a creative and inspired individual witness. Paradoxically, Merton was not dismayed by the loss of the authority of Christendom in the West. Having detached itself at last from the invidious effects of the sharing of power with secular rulers, Christianity could, freed from the temptations of political power, offer its healing to the world. While calling for peacemakers who were nonviolent resistors, as well as in some cases heroes and martyrs, Merton nevertheless left the seemingly intractable conflicts that would yet remain in the hands of God, a God of history who would in time, he believed, weave all things into a mantle of peace. Thank you. Just about out of time, so don't know if you want to comment or yes.
I was struck by just the comparison of the Danish Act against the Nazi terrorism versus the Danish cartoon against what you might call the Islamic terrorism. Now, is that just a reflection in our cultural
change,
mores, or is that a difference in attitude? How do you see that?
I see it as two very different nations and cultures. The insensitivity, I suppose, which you're referring to in the more recent example, I think reflects a change in culture from the time that Merton was writing about. So, and we undoubtedly have experienced similar changes in culture here in North America. And he was aware of that as well. So that for Merton, in North America, it would be foolish and misleading to expect such a response, he felt, as the Janus response had been in the 60s, at a very time when Kennedy was on the throne, so to speak, in the States. And we had still the trappings of a Christian ethos. We were still wrapped in it a bit in the early 60s, but for Merton, that was all illusion. We were nowhere near where the Danes had been, and they are nowhere near where they had been at this time. Yes. Yes.
I have two small questions. The first, I'd like to know, according to me, Merton has a big influence among people of his culture, in Western culture. And at the same time, yet also a big message, what I can call an intercultural message.
Yes.
For peace and freedom. That is my first question.
Okay, let's deal with that one then. So Merton has, in a way, cultivated this population of people like himself. We're here today. And so in certain circles, even in North America, it's possible to find people of a similar way of thinking. And in fact, in this country, I would think, with its multicultural emphasis in recent years, Merton would approve of this sort of change in the culture. This is a very different culture from the culture I grew up in. So that internationalism of which Merton was very convinced is present in societies like this one, and at one time I would have said was dominant in the last 40 years or so in this one. As I said before, we seem to have lost our way in that respect. But the thing about Merton is his writings are so addressed to humanity itself, they're so open-ended in their sense of audience, that he's not writing for specific cultural groups at all. He's writing for mankind, for human beings in general. That is his audience. And he I think, embodied the kind of unity, both in a biological sense and also in a cultural sense, which he saw in Christ and Gandhi, and which, in a way, he models for us.
Well, thank you. Now, my last question is, if you were during the Second Council,
yes.
In Rome, I saw that he took some positions against Vatican in his books. Do you know something about this?
Yes, I don't know if it'd be against the Vatican. I think the question is, did Merton take positions in the time of the Vatican Council against the Vatican? Well, the Council itself involved the Church, the whole Church coming together under a remarkably liberal Pope at the time. So I would not think in any way that, I mean, I've quoted from John the 23rd here, his famous encyclical Pacem in Terris came out in this period and was respected and received with pleasure by the whole world, really. It's a wonderful document. So I would say Merton and John the 23rd were lined up pretty well together. The Vatican, well, that's another matter. The arcane doings of the Vatican, I'm afraid, are beyond my reach as a scholar in this area. So I have no comment to make except to say this, that from what I've seen of the documents of Vatican II, they are very much in harmony with Merton's views of things. Much more then, in some ways, than later. Yes?
You started off by saying that the ultimate conclusion of your position is that nonviolence is rational.
Yes.
What do we do in the face of a threat which appears to come from someone who seemingly is not open to rational dialogue? How does rationality and nonviolence enter into a confrontation with that kind?
Yes. I described Merton's the structure of his mind with regard to these issues originally as balanced, and I think it really is in this case as well. He would concede that if Hitler is moved against you, someone like Hitler or someone like this man you're talking about in North Korea, he would accept the fact that you had a right to defend yourself. He would then go on to say that you would probably go morally wrong in the way in which you did that. you would probably fall away from your original intention, from the Augustinian just war, so to speak. But I suppose ultimately he would say, with regard to peacemaking, that you would talk, you would collaborate with the enemy. You would find a way to do that. You may have to do it through another person, through another nation, but you would find a way to make them want to do that with North Korea, whether the nation be China or some other nation. So I think he feels that a lot of the negotiations and conflicts that arise in the world are done at arm's length and don't involve the sort of collaboration which he recommends. And he also, of course, recommends not only collaboration, but a sense of what he calls the rightness of the enemy's position, or the rightness of the adversary's position. So he would demand that we acknowledge that publicly to the adversary, that you are right about this particular thing. You were wrongly treated, let's say, if that's the aggravation in some way. And use that clearing of the air to substitute real attitudes and principles and history for what you are claiming it divides you for that. So I think that's that. Again, he's an internationalist. He would tend to not at all favor the way in which we're dealing with the situation in the Middle East now for that reason. So against an unjust aggressor, he says quite blankly, if you do nothing, if you lie down in front of that aggressor's tank, so to speak, you are encouraging evil, because you are encouraging an evil person to act on that evil. So there's a balance there. So he wants all of these things weighed and where there is a possibility of action acted upon. Yes?
I have a view that when conflicts, such as between nations, appear to be totally beyond resolution, that often it's because earlier, sometimes decades earlier, one side, usually the stronger, failed to take actions, or took actions that were allowed, that are ultimately leading their consequences. For example, let's say that if after World War I, the victorious Allies had not adopted a policy of revenge and punishment, history may have taken a very different course from Germany, and I don't know, perhaps, and there may not have been. Or not in the case of the North Korea. There are those who are saying that, for example, the United States has broken agreements, promises which they made earlier, such as 1994, which have accelerated this.
Yes.
I wonder if that's not true.
I agree with you entirely, and Merton would say that until those wrongs and those lies have been, the breaks in faith between, or trust between nations have been acknowledged by the nations involved, the other thing he would insist upon is the ability of, on our part, to identify with the humanity of the other side, so to speak. That's the really strong thing that he feels has to occur, and that seems to be as hard to get as what you're describing, but they are the things he says we must do. Okay, yes?
I was hesitating about asking the question, still coming into my spirit. My affinity to Thomas Merton is more than his, I would say, this way, maybe in keeping with what he was thought about in other ways. His appreciation of the unknowable, his appreciation that discipline which was language, human language, was not capable of expressing, which was a place of nexus with God, intimacy with God. And I'm wondering, in my own academic and spiritual life, I've come to a place, and I realize it's a very personal thing, but I've come to a place where the cerebral has a ceiling. And then beyond the cerebral is what I might call human spirit, which is greater than it represents the sum of us. Of course, you would refer to the whole person. My sense is that between, and it could be an artificial construct, but between the seed of what is knowable and what is the whole person, which includes the spirit dimension, is a place for God to take hold of us and work through our being, which you refer to, and surprise us with response. And I say that in conjunction with your emphasis on the rational.
Well, at the very end, in the very last sentence, I pointed to conflicts which are apparently intractable. And Merton believed that there especially, but I could have said elsewhere as well, only God can work what needs to be done. I have a lot of interest in the subject that you are interested in as well. I've thought a lot about it, and I've done some writing about that area. There's a very wonderful piece by Merton about that sense of himself in a kind of intimacy with God, in a piece called The Fire Watch, which was in the Sign of Jonas, the early journal which Merton wrote. It's the very end of that book. It's a story of Merton's going through the monastery at night while his brother monks were asleep and keeping an eye on the place, punching in as he moved from station to station. And as he moved through different historical periods of the monastery's construction as he did this. And at one point he goes up a tower and he just sort of there, sitting there and looking out at the night sky. And at that moment he has this wonderful sense of the intimacy of God and of that embracing providential presence of God in his own life at that very moment. I'm sure he sees God in that way always in any discussion one could have about war, peace, or any other subject he was interested in. And so in a way I'm cutting loose here from something I otherwise think about and write about a good deal in connection with Merton. The one thing that I suppose you can say brings them together is the fact that, as he says, that the person who is deeply aware of that kind of intimacy with God and with the whole of creation will love that creation, will protect it, will do everything to protect it, whether it's environmental or military or whatever, because it is from God, because it is good, essentially. So that seems to me something axiomatic in Merton as one encounters him. There's always that sense that the contemplative has a jump, so to speak, on peacemakers, because there's that initial predisposition towards the whole planet and towards the universe, towards the God intimately connected with these, and will struggle to protect those things, those parts of creation. I think I'm kind of way over my time here. Thank you very much.